Welcome to the Pata Martins podcast. My name is Céline Terranova. I'm an author and brand new podcaster here to help you in your creative career. This show is all about advice, support, and inspiration for performers, writers, musicians, and any kind of artist. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Part-Time Artist Podcast, episode 7 already. Today, my guest is Andy Robertson. He is a gaming journalist, and together we talk about how he created and developed a very successful YouTube channel, how he integrates his family into his creative business, and how he took the leap from a comfortable day job to working for himself. But as usual, let's start first with the latest news for the Part-Time Artist. I am currently recording the audiobook version of The Part-Time Artist. It's quite an experience for me, and it's taking quite a lot of effort, but I'm glad that I can use my own voice to tell my story. I will let you know when it comes out, and it will be probably on Audible and iTunes. On the website, I published an article about how to make sure that you complete your projects. It's so easy to start something, but finishing it is much more difficult, especially when you have this new, shiny project around the corner. So if you have a problem with that, read the article to get my 8 tips to always finish what you start. That's all for today, so now it's time for the interview. Don't forget that you can support this show on Patreon and get more episodes! I have just published a new Patreon exclusive where I talk about writing therapy. It's my method to work through your feelings if you are overwhelmed. I give you 3 steps to feel better thanks to the power of writing. My sponsorship starts at $2 per month, and you can stop whenever you want, so you can test and see if you like the bonuses. And you can decide the content of my next special episodes. If you are interested, check out my Patreon page, patreon.com/thepartimeartist, patreon.com/thepartimeartist. So today I am interviewing Andy Robertson, who is a gaming journalist and a successful YouTuber. Welcome to the podcast, Andy.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Thank you very much for taking time to speak to me and to talk about what you're doing. So if you can tell the listeners exactly what it is that you do.
It usually depends who I'm talking to, how I sort of tell this story, because I wear a variety of different hats. But kind of a main part of what I do is I'm a journalist specializing in video games and technology, and in particular, the intersection between technology and family life. So I have a kind of a niche in the kind of family gaming, family technology area, and I write for national newspapers, or I have a blog on part of the Forbes online presence, and I do a bit of TV and radio around that. But then for a younger audience, I also have a YouTube channel, which is largely content aimed at kids, but designed to be consumed with sort of parents and children watching together. That's, and there are a few other things as well, but I think those are the top two.
It's the Family Gamer TV YouTube channel, right?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, and I have watched a few videos. Of course, there's a lot of them on the channel. And you have also a second channel, I think, Family Gamer Radio. Now, you have a lot of videos, and some of them are reaching millions of views. You have a lot of subscribers too. How did that project start?
I think like a lot of people on YouTube, kind of by accident. So I was covering a video game out in New York at Toy Fair, Skylanders Giants, back in 2012. And I'd been fiddling around with YouTube. I'd done a few little episodes. People could go back and watch them. They're all there on the channel, and kind of had thought I was going to do like a TV show for parents about video games, and had got together with another dad who knew how to do video, and we played about with it. But I also knew that people were just using iPhones just to film video and do it in quite a low-tech way without a big expensive camera. And so while I was out at this press event for this game, I did a little video about this new game. Went to the hotel, and I was going out for a meal in the evening, so I did a bit of editing. Thought I would do it then rather than having to do it when I got back home. Set it uploading. Was out at the meal, checked YouTube, and then looked at the numbers and thought, oh, YouTube's broken again, because at the time it was always misreporting statistics. because it was something like 5,000 or 6,000 views already on this video that I'd obviously only just published. So I went back to the hotel kind of expecting to see a more reasonable number and to see it corrected, which is usually what happened. By that time, it was something like 10,000. And so that was, you know, really nice and sort of fortuitous. But it got me sort of thinking, well, I'm getting a bigger audience here on my own YouTube channel than I am in some of the articles I'll be writing for different places. And so as a freelance, you know, freelance self-employed person, I needed to sort of figure out how to replicate that. Because although at the time I wasn't making any money from that, I hadn't thought about monetizing the channel or anything. There obviously, with that size of audience, there was a potential to grow something. And so that was back in 2012. So from that point, I kind of carved out a part of my week to focus on trying to figure out what happened and then try and replicate it. And that's the trick, I think, particularly on YouTube. You'll see quite a lot of people who have a kind of a lucky hit, and then you'll see them doing other videos trying to replicate it and trying to figure out what happens, which is very difficult because sometimes it's just timing. And then often a lot of them will then kind of drift off, and after trying for a few months, you see their channels are just dormant. So so that's how it began.
And I've watched actually some of your first videos. I've watched the pilot of the channel, and to me,
really?
It was, yes, I did. Yeah, I love doing that actually. When I like a new YouTube channel, I like to go and see the first videos to see where they came from and how much progress they've done, which is quite impressive most of the time. And to me, what was really impressive is that you already had sort of a very precise subject, and you already had it's kind of like the trailer of your channel is in your pilot actually, because it's very interesting to see that you already knew what you wanted to talk about and you already communicated it in the first video. Do you think that's also one of the reasons why you got so many subscribers?
I think you do need to have a focus, because that's how you build the audience. You know, the people will watch your videos because they're about something. But I think a bigger thing is just having the willpower to keep going, and to keep producing regular videos longer than other people can, because that's how channels kind of rise to the top, I think, is because those are the people who have carried on when it seemed like there was nothing to carry on. But I think at the same time as that, you need to find a way of doing that without driving yourself crazy. You know, you need to find a way of being able to do that and for it not to be a heavy load on you every day, not to be a big pressure, and not to worry too much if those videos aren't performing. And that's, you know, that as a, if you're working on your own on a project, to do that for more than a few months is really difficult. And I think that it's often that more than just raw talent that makes a difference, that be having the kind of the belligerence or the willpower, whatever it is, to be able to treat yourself kindly and carry on doing what you need to do is a real trick.
Yeah, and I think it's also important to just enjoy doing these videos, because it's a lot of work to make a video. I've started actually a YouTube channel, and it's a lot of work to just make one video. So if you're not enjoying your subject, if you're not enjoying just making all of these videos, you're never going to last long.
Yeah. And so it has to be something that you just want to talk about anyway. It has to be a subject you know about. But then you do have that kind of double-edged sword, because if you do it as I did, I you know, I enjoyed video games and I like toys and technology, and so that means that you turn kind of a hobby into work. So it has a kind of a double-edged thing to it. But if it's something that you enjoy already, and if it's a topic you're passionate about, that's kind of the magic or the joy of YouTube, really, is that you can walk that line of a hobby and a profitable business. And if you get it right, and if you get, you know, if you're a bit fortunate and there's some good timing, then, you know, you can get a really nice audience and you can enjoy that. I think the trick with YouTube, though, is, or the tricky thing, is that it's hard to feel secure in that. And so, you know, even now I feel like I've got a really good audience and there's a really good, you know, brand around the channel. So I'm quite confident in that. But in terms of revenue or how the channel's going to be positioned on YouTube, that's just down to their algorithm. So, you know, like a Google algorithm. So that's another challenging thing, that if you put all your eggs in that basket, you are kind of dependent on chasing that algorithm. And so you end up being distracted from maybe what you should be doing in terms of your actual content.
Oh, absolutely. It's always a problem of depending on one platform. That platform could basically close tomorrow and suddenly you have zero revenues. The same as for people who publish only on Amazon, for example. If Amazon decide that they are not going to publish books anymore, well, all your revenues are gone. So do you think it's important to diversify your stream of revenues when you are an entrepreneur like that?
Yeah, I think it's really, I think it is really important. And it's something that I haven't done very well, because I've got a much bigger following on YouTube than the other channels, because all the other like social media and stuff, like, I, you know, I could have easily have pursued Instagram or Facebook. And, you know, there's lots of family, you know, that's where families are largely on Facebook, as I see it. And so I should have a bigger audience there, but I've never managed to crack that. And so as well, along with, you know, being kind of platform sort of neutral, platform agnostic, I've heard it called, it's hard to do that, because, you know, becoming an expert in one platform on its own is a challenge enough. And so if you have put that time in and you become an expert, then inevitably you're going to gravitate towards it. And so I think for me, I just thought, well, I know YouTube, I'm going to just ride this, you know, YouTube wave as long as I can, but at the same time not assume it's going to carry on like this forever, and not kind of count my chickens, or not sort of, you know, realize that a large part of this is kind of a fortunate timing, and, you know, just getting it right for a certain amount of time, and that doesn't necessarily carry on forever. So not feel, you know, not feel like I'm dependent on it, but to make the most of it while I can, I think probably is my perspective.
Oh, absolutely. That's very wise, I think. Now let's talk about the topic of your YouTube channel, video games. I have watched your TEDx talk that you did a few years ago, where you talked about the social stigma about video games. And video games, even though it's booming at the moment, is still an industry that is very misunderstood by quite a lot of people. And what I see, my point of view, is that it's full of passionate people and great artists, and there's so much potential into it. So first of all, maybe what got you into video games?
Well, I played games growing up. So I had like a Commodore 64 and a Spectrum, and then had an Amiga, and then kind of drifted off a bit. And it wasn't until probably after university I came back and realised that the sort of gaming had moved on in the kind of PlayStation era. And I think something about escaping to these different worlds, I didn't quite understand what it was at the time, but there was a kind of a comfort or an intrigue about that, and something which I guess has persisted, seeing them as more than entertainment, as they would, like, they told stories, but you spent time with characters in these worlds that they created. So it was as if the games were creating space for you to enter, and you could play a different role. So It was this kind of strange mix that didn't feel like books, didn't feel like TV, didn't feel like, you know, music. It was this kind of new media. And I guess it felt like it was kind of the media of my era. I was growing up and it was just emerging, and it was the way we were starting to tell stories. And that's kind of what fed into that TEDx talk. And that was back in 2012. And that kind of thread of my work has kind of carried on sort of alongside the more sort of day-to-day, just looking at technology and looking at games, and the sort of more giving advice and support to parents to sort of help sort of care for their children if they've got kids who really like video games. That's a very contested space, I think, that there's lots of advice in lots of different directions, and quite a lot of people trying to make money really out of potential dangers in video games. And I'm keen to sort of put parents in control and help them be parents, which they're really good at. So that kind of was the seed in that TEDx talk. But it's funny because it's so long ago, but actually most of the stuff I've said there, which is was essentially saying games are more than entertainment. They're these meaningful ways of telling stories, but the problem is they're kind of locked away and only a small proportion of society can access them. And what I was saying in the talk is we need to start talking differently about video games so that more people can benefit from them. And so now to translate that, whatever it is, 6-7 years later, and I'm using that same rhetoric, but applying it to a family setting of trying to help parents have better conversations with their children about video games, which leads me to, I guess, an unusual stance, which is to say, if you've got a child who loves video games, the best way or a very good way of parenting them is to play games yourself. At the same time, acknowledge that most parents, most parents will say, well, I don't play games because they're for kids. I'm never going to play a game. So that's ridiculous advice. So then I've created some resources to try and move them beyond that and sort of say, well, there are some games that you could try as an adult that I think you would find interesting and engaging. So why don't you try this? It's very quick to play. You can play it on a smartphone. It's about a theme that is obviously addressed to a grown up. Maybe it's about cancer. Maybe it's about refugees. You know, maybe it's about parenting. So these are things that aren't really aimed at kids, but it will give you an understanding of that area of life in a way that nothing else will. You know, you're stepping into an experience of walking in the shoes of someone in that setting. And if you can get someone to do that, particularly a parent, then suddenly the conversation about games in the home completely changes, rather than the parents feeling they have to police and how much screen time is too long and, you know, is my child playing a game that's inappropriate? So suddenly it's a thing that you do together, and the games are rooted in that family setting and just become another normal part of family life, which is, I think, what they are. So that kind of thread of what I write and what I do kind of evolved from that TEDx talk.
That's very interesting what you're saying. I completely agree. I play video games myself, so I kind of agree with your way of thinking, because I think a lot of people just completely reject the idea of video games and just take on all these so-called experts who say that it's bad for the children, that it changes their way of thinking, etc. Well, really, you can't really avoid video games anymore. That much, really, because you have them not only, like, I would say real video games on consoles and PC, but you have also on the phone, on the iPads. Now children are just exposed to it, so you might as well try it too, right?
Yeah, exactly. And it's not saying, I mean, I think one of the things we might talk about is the book I'm writing that led on from this, and that's got a title of Taming Gaming. So it's a negative title, really. It's saying that games need taming. They're not all just, it's not simple. And I think that the advice needs to go those two things. Like, games are really new and interesting and unavoidable. But at the same time, if you have them in the home and you're a parent who doesn't play, they are difficult to have there in a positive way. And they require you to engage in them all the more. Which is why the sort of scary headlines or the medicalization of potential addictions and that sort of thing can make parents take a step back, which actually makes the situation worse. So a lot of the things I do in that sphere are trying to empower parents to have the confidence and literacy in terms of video game literacy to step into that space and play that parenting role. But it's not easy. So I'm trying to sort of say it's not easy, but if you watch this video, or, you know, spend 10 minutes a day reading the book, and actually it can become a lot easier.
Let's talk about that book, actually, because you are currently writing it, right? It's not finished. Can you just tell me a bit more about the project and also the crowdfunding? Because you had people actually helping you get that project going.
Yeah, so it came off of, I do a Patreon project, which offers video content and advice around video games for parents. And the publisher has seen those videos and came to me and said, we think that a book would actually be a nice way of doing this. And at first I was like, well, why would you do a book? Because obviously these are video games. And so be able to see them in moving, you know, in that, the actual form that they're created, surely that makes sense. And you can do it so much more succinctly in a 2-minute video. But their point was that actually there's a whole load of parents who just aren't into watching videos. That's not where they spend their time, but they would spend time sitting down with a really beautiful book. And so they had a vision for a full hardback, full colour, kind of 250-page book. And then between us, we hatched sort of, what would that look like? And we decided, well, the first half, or maybe the first third of the book, would be this kind of advice we've been talking about, of what are video games, what do they really do to children, what are the actual dangers rather than the perceived ones, how can you actually properly mitigate them, and how can you actually care for a child properly who loves video games without stigmatizing it, and actually enjoy that together and benefit from it. So you have that as the first bit, but then it tackles the kind of the kind of the literacy or the discoverability of really amazing games by having a whole load of recipes in the back. And these aren't recipes for food, they're recipes for video games. So on double page spreads, the sort of the visuals of the game are laid out like you would in a recipe book. But rather than ingredients, in terms of food ingredients, you have the sort of the technology that you need to play it, whether that's a PlayStation or a smartphone, how you buy the game, you know, how much it costs, if there are any subscriptions that you require. Then it goes on to give you a brief sort of method of how you might play it and some serving suggestions of how other families have enjoyed it. And then at the end, there's some suggestions of what you might play afterwards, so something to follow. So it has that kind of foodie feel. And the idea is that a parent who maybe doesn't even know anything about games, maybe has never played a game, can pick up that book and flick through it and find games in the back which are categorized in sort of unusual groupings that would, you know, appeal to sort of everyday people, like solving a mystery or going on an adventure or living in another world or collaborating or walking in someone else's shoes, and find something that they actually want to play themselves, or they want their children to play, or they want to play together. And most of those games, you know, the majority of the parents I'm in contact with probably won't have heard of them. So I won't be talking very much at all about Fortnite or FIFA or Call of Duty or a lot about Mario or those other games, because everyone knows about those. So the games I'm talking about are the sort of more niche ones, or the ones which are popular but aren't, are more sort of peculiar, so hard to understand. So Rocket League is one that a sort of crossover I will mention because it's more than it seems, that kind of thing. So that's the idea. So it's kind of a recipe book for gaming, basically.
That's awesome. I had never heard of anything like that. That's very original. And I think it's perfect for the audience. And I'm kind of really interested into the process of your publisher talking about your target audience and the product being created from the taste of your target audience, which is usually... writers would do the other way around. They would have an idea and then try to find an audience that fits to that idea. But for you, you started completely from the opposite. You started from the idea of these parents who don't know anything about video games and might like reading recipe books. So that's awesome.
Yeah, I think it's quite interesting. And the way that the publisher works is it's a crowdfunding publisher. So it's a proper full publishing house, but they offset the risk of publishing by getting the author to crowdfund pre-orders, basically. I mean, it's not quite as black and white as that. You're sort of crowdfunding support, really. But every supporter gets a copy of the book, so they essentially are pre-ordering it. And so that means that they can take a risk on books which other publishers would struggle to do, which I think is really nice. And they've had some really big successes with books that have gone on to be Booker nominated or have, you know, been very high-profile books that other publishers have turned down because they can offset that risk. It works well. But although, you know, any crowdfunding is really difficult. And so when I started crowdfunding the book, it seemed like I wasn't going to fund it because we were aiming really high. I had to raise, I think it's on the site, it's about 20 grand or something like that, mm-hmm. to publish it. So that was a high target. Doing that individually with individual families, even though I had had maybe 150, 160 families sign up quite relatively quickly, I realized that I needed more than 1,000. And so that was a challenge. But what I found was because it was a book that was kind of, you know, well thought of and the idea was liked by various companies and charities or sort of support organizations, then that I've had companies support the book. And so I came up with this idea with the publisher that a company could support it and they'd get a number of pre-orders. And then in return, in a very transparent way, they get a logo on the back. To say they've supported the book, then there's no editorial control there. They're just kind of there as like a supporter and a cheerleader sort of thing, and that means that then they get a bunch of copies that they can then share with people and sort of say, look, here's something that, you know, wouldn't have existed. So I really appreciate those companies that have supported it, because it genuinely wouldn't be a thing. I think parents really need it, and it wouldn't have existed unless it had had that support.
That's an incredibly creative way to enhance your crowdfunding and just not asking your audience but asking big companies. That's incredible. I had never heard of anyone doing this actually before, and I'm quite impressed, and I think that's a great thing that other writers might want to check out. What's the website? What's the publisher website?
So the publisher's called Unbound. If you just go to unbound.com, you can submit yeah, you can submit a manuscript, or there's a whole process.
Yeah, I'm sure. I will put all the links anyway in the show notes. So if someone is interested, maybe has a project that they would like to maybe do something similar to what you've done, maybe they will be interested in that. So my next question, because we talked about a lot of children and gaming and family, etc. I found interesting that in these videos that you do, you include your family, you include other families too. And I have a lot of questions from artists and entrepreneurs who are wondering how to juggle their work with having children, a family. I mean, I understand that it takes so much time, and sometimes it might be a deterrent having a family. They're not sure if they can pursue their dream, if they can do something that they are really passionate about. So how do you find the time to do everything, and how do you manage to incorporate a family life into this?
I think sometimes is if you're doing something, if you're creating content that comes out of family life, you can then potentially, you know, there's a nice overlap. But I think the reality of that is that any time you turn family life into, oh, I'll just film this, for this will be useful, that suddenly turns it into not family time and into work time. Although, you know, you might, you know, the family might put up with it for a while. So I think there's a kind of a false assumption, or there's a mistake that I made probably. And it is difficult to navigate. Because you know that, you know, if you're all playing a game together, actually, this might be quite a nice bit of content for the channel. But equally, you don't want to make every time you sit down with the family like dad's YouTube time or whatever. And I think it depends on how the kids respond to that as well. Sometimes they want to do it, sometimes they don't. And that's what has actually made it much easier in recent years to work with other families. So rather than just using my own family or kids to do videos, because they basically got fed up with it. that novelty was fresh for other people. And so me talking to parents and booking in with them to come and play a game with their family for an afternoon and filming. And there's obviously the appropriate sign-offs and due diligence and those sort of protections in place. But that meant that when I was filming, it was more of a formal thing. And so everyone knew what was happening. There was no grey area. And also, I think other people's kids do what you say. Well, your own children don't necessarily do that. They're like, it's just dad. But if you've got the YouTube guy who's come to film, he's like, oh, could you, you know, you need to play that level again. They're like, oh, yeah, sure. Yeah. What do I need to do? You know, that sort of thing. And so, so that I think that definitely has worked well. But it is, to fit it all in, it is a juggle. And I think you just need to work that both ways. So there'll be times when you're extra busy creating content or whatever you're doing or writing that will detract from family times. But also, hopefully, and it's not a guarantee, but it will also, if you can develop some flexibility in your paid work, it means it won't work the other way. So you can take impromptu holidays, or if the kids are off from school. So for in my situation, if one of our children are ill because I work from home, then it doesn't affect my partner and how she works, or where previously she'd have to call in and say, I can't come in because this kid's, you know, we've got a child at home. And so there's that flexibility. And I think it's really important not just to think, oh, that's just something, you know, neither here nor there, but that's quite a valuable thing. So if you're able to create your own schedule and work around it, and then be clear about, you know, when you get those advantages, you know, and those possibilities of being flexible, to really value those and go for it, and think, actually, I don't have any work to do today. I don't need to sit in the office like it's a 9-to-5. Or maybe I've tried it for an hour or two and it's not worked, and you can really try some very different approaches. So one of the things that has complemented my writing, I think, is that I'm a keen runner, and so I'll often start work quite early and then by sort of 2 p.m. maybe feel like I've kind of done as much as I can, particularly if I'm trying to do creative work. And then I can sort of down tools and go for a run and clear my head, and then be back at home ready for the kids coming home from school. So that flexibility, I think, has been a real help to me.
That's awesome. And I think that is one of the advantages of being freelance, being an entrepreneur. You don't have to deal with the schedule of work. But were you always freelance having a family and being freelance, or was it something that you turn into? So did you have, I would say, a normal job and then started doing all these YouTube and writing and everything? And if so, was there a discussion maybe with your partner, with your family?
Yeah, so I went to university and did a computer science degree and then got a job in the computing industry, basically. I always liked writing, so I ended up doing like the online help and the computer manuals, and so I had a variety of jobs that did that, but they're all office-based, and it wasn't, you know, it's not, it is writing, but it's not creative writing, because you're just telling someone how to use a piece of tax software, you know, what buttons to press to do their tax returns, which is important, but isn't that stimulating.
Yeah.
So I had the, so essentially what happened was, I had a, I'm not even sure how the conversation started, but I got to know somebody who was running a website that reviewed Nintendo games, and it was the era of the Wii. And he was just chatting to me on Messenger, I think it was, back in the day, and saying, oh, he was struggling to find anybody to review the latest Madden game, which is like an American football game, on the Wii. And so I said, oh, I'll review it. And so he sent it to me, you know, got some friends over, and we played it together, we took some pictures, and I wrote up a short review, which was then published. And so then I got in touch with him and said, oh, where do I send the game back? And he said, oh, you know, you can keep the game, it's kind of like, you know, that's your benefit from spending the time reviewing it, you know, we get sent them for free, you can keep it. And so that made me think, oh, there's, you know, there's, that's interesting, I'm getting free games, I quite like this. So as a hobby, I just kind of developed that over probably a couple of years, and just ended up writing reviews for a few different websites, and kind of worked my way up a little bit, so some larger sites. And after a couple of years, it seemed like there was enough money in what I was doing, in the kind of freelance writing, to support support a family. But I couldn't tell if that was true without quitting the day job. And so I sort of faced this relatively difficult situation where I had to decide, should I carry on at the 9 to 5, or should I take a risk? And I talked it through with my wife, and she basically said, you know, at some point we need to see if this is going to work or not, and so why don't we do it sooner rather than later, and then you'll know, you know, you can always get another job. And I was like, I'm not sure that's true. I had quite a nice cushy job, really, and I knew that if I left it, it wouldn't just be, I would be into a probably a more difficult job for less money. So there was a degree of risk there, but actually I handed my notice in and quit the job and went full time, expecting, I had a bit of savings, expecting to sort of struggle financially. And actually, because I could focus on the writing full time and pitching features and doing that kind of work, the money side of it was never a problem. There were other challenges of becoming self-employed. So just the psychology of just having to do work to make someone pay you. You know, previously, I knew that I'd get my salary every month, kind of whatever I did, whereas suddenly I'd only get any money coming in if I did something for someone who would pay me for it. You know, I never liked the idea of performance-related pay. I always looked at the sales jobs in my company and thought, oh, I could never do that. And I realized kind of after leaving, I was basically on 100% for performance-related pay. So I was only getting paid if I performed. So that side was a bigger adjustment than the finances. But there was a risk there. And I think I don't know it was going to pay off. And I did, I think I had enough savings that if I had not made any money, I would have been okay for half a year, and then I could have got another job. So I think you need to be quite cautious about those approaches, and you need to be able to give yourself enough time to do stuff without worrying about making money. And I guess that's my main thing on the internet, is that's kind of how it seems to work, that if you do something well for long enough without worrying about if it makes money, that's getting builds a good audience, then one way or another that will become valuable, and then one way or another you will eventually get paid. When you start doing the thing you're doing, then it's not often obvious, well, how will this make money? And so it's hard to justify both to yourself and other people. But it's the people that can carry on doing it who are now, you know, in the YouTube space, those kids who are just making videos in their room and their parents were complaining about are now the Dan TDMs of this world, because they're the ones who carried on doing it. Whereas the ones that did that and would, and you know, listen to their parents and did something much more productive, and now, I don't know, doctors or something instead, and you know, I don't know which is better, but that being able to persevere at something without worrying about it making an income, if you're able to make that scenario happen, then I think you're a long way towards that success, rather than just kind of it's not just about sort of, you know, being hugely talented or hugely skillful. It's about creating that environment where you can just iterate on what you're doing so you can improve on it.
And my last question would be, what would be your best piece of advice? And I'm thinking, especially in the scenario that you're talking about, where you are not yet making money, you have to persevere, you know you have to persevere, but you don't have any proof that what you're doing is ever going to work. So what's your best piece of advice for someone in that situation?
I think you need to think honestly whether you want to do this full time and what the reality of doing that full time would be like. Because I think often we can kind of, you know, we create this fantasy job where, because it's about something we love, it's perfect. But, you know, the stuff I'm doing day to day, emails, spreadsheets, organizing, writing, is very similar to the work I was doing when I was writing help for tax software. But what's different about it is I'm doing it for myself. And so I think that's a good thing to think. Do I want to be someone who's self-employed and this is what I do only? I think once you've decided that you do want to do that, I think it's get really good feedback. So to make a plan of where you want to get to, and just start doing it as if you are going to get there. And so if it's YouTube, you look at YouTube and you think, okay, well, the way that YouTube has become popular is they do very regular content, and whatever that is. For me, it was a video a day, and that's probably a bit much these days. I don't know. You see, you sort of lose touch with what YouTube's like in a way. But assess what you need to do, then start doing it as if you're going to be successful. But then go out and look for really honest feedback from other people, particularly people who are in the industry that you want to get into. So if I'm ever approached by a new journalist who wants to be a writer or someone who wants to get into YouTube, I'm very happy to spend half an hour looking at what they're doing and giving them some very frank feedback, because I know how valuable that is. So I think most people, if you approach them, you know, politely and persistently, then they will offer you some good advice. And then finally, I think, and particularly maybe this is just a journalism thing, I think having unique ideas and an actual original hook for the stories you're pitching is really important. So if, rather than just writing to whoever, The Guardian, and saying, you know, I want to be a writer, or I'm an up and coming journalist, I've written for these sites, and would you let me review this new game? Pitch an actual idea, you know, look at game, do some research, do that kind of journalistic background sort of due diligence stuff, and then you can pitch an actual something that nobody else can, because then you've got a story. And I think it, particularly in the internet, you know, be aware that editors are really busy. Now that works both for you and against you. It works against you because it's hard to get their attention, and you have to be politely persistent. So I'll often email people 3, 4, 5 times in the course of a week. But once you've got their attention, because they're busy, it's kind of hard for them to say no if you give them a really original idea where you've got the quotes, you can show that you're going to be an easy person to work with, you've got some supporting images, and it's going to be an easy tick in their day's list of things they need to publish, and it's quite hard for them to say no. So that, yeah, I mean, and a lot of this advice is quite specific, for it depends what you're doing, but I think those things together can stand you in some good stead. But really, it's just find people who are doing what you want to do and just find a way to talk to them, you know, however that is, just to get that kind of knowledge.
Oh my God, that's a gold mine of advice. that's amazing. And there's a lot of things that actually made me think also for my own business. So thank you so much. Now, where can people find you?
Well, my main thing I'm pushing at the minute is the book, because I'm just finishing that manuscript now, which means you can pre-order it Unbound. If you just Google Taming Gaming, I think it'll be the first one that comes up, but you could go to unbound.com. Yeah, unbound.com/Taming Gaming. Mm-hmm. But if you just Google Taming Gaming, you'll soon find it. And you can pre-order an ebook version, which is £10, or the full color version, which is £25. I've already seen the early bird discount ones just set out just today, actually. So I think it's going to be hard to get when it actually launches. They will republish it, and it's not going to be impossible to get in the long term. But if you want to get in early and get one of those nice early copies, then that's a good place to go. On Twitter, I'm there as Geek Dad Gamer. Yeah, YouTube is Family Gamer TV. There is Family Gamer Radio, which is like a sort of a second channel where I do. So the main channel, the Family Gamer TV channel, is now aimed more at kind of slightly more entertaining kind of videos for younger children, with the idea that parents are watching with them. Whereas Family Gamer Radio is more aimed at advice for parents, as I kind of have separated those two audiences. Mm-hmm. So that's how that works. So there's other places I could talk about, but I think those are really the book, I think, is where I'm looking to connect people at the moment, because I think it's a really unusual thing. And I'm always keen to hear what people make of it as well. So.
Oh, absolutely. And for the listeners, I will put all those links in the show notes so you can click directly. You don't have to search. That's going to be easy. Andy, thank you so much for being here with the podcast. It was super, super interesting. I hope you had a good time.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah,
really and good. Thank you very much for the listeners, and I'll see you in 2 weeks. Thank you for listening to the Pata Matis podcast. If you want more advice and inspiration, head to the website thepartumartistinoneword.com, and don't forget to subscribe and leave a review if you enjoyed the show.